Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham nama sami. Last week I was talking about a kind of contexts that the Buddha's teaching was taught in, and the teachings that we have from the texts are usually given to individuals or given to groups of practitioners, and they always have a kind of context, either a question to the Buddha or some problem needs solving, or some confusion, or whatever. And I said this last week, but there is a, if the Buddha in the text, if he saw someone who was, he thought he was new to the tradition, he would offer a kind of a gradual teaching. So nowadays, there are elements of Buddhism which are taught out of those contexts. That's bad, but so mindfulness and stress reduction is taught just as that, and the larger context of where the Buddha would teach that is not sometimes indicated. So that's always good to bear in mind, that there's a whole foundation of teachings before we even are recommended to meditate. So the just to go through those elements, I've been going through these this summer, but the first element that the Buddha would emphasize was generosity. And all these elements that he recommended or pointed to were ways of doing rather than just positions, philosophical positions or moral positions, which were somehow simply intellectually taken. Rather, they were ways of living, ways of developing the heart. So they were doings rather than believings. And so generosity was the sort of opening gesture that the Buddha thought was terribly important, because the generous heart is already moving well away from selfishness. And selfishness in its various forms is what really prevents the deeper understanding of the heart. So if one enters into meditation with some kind of a selfish intention to gain some kind of experience one has had before in a retreat, or to try to get some level of meditative experience that one might have read about, that very kind of grasping and that kind of selfishness would block the path, make meditation very, very difficult. So the cultivation of generosity, as we all know, in and of itself, it's very beautiful, it's very fulfilling. It brings a lot of good memories, it brings a real settling of the mind, it brings confidence. It's fun, it's lovely to be generous, it's lovely to have resources to be generous, but just a generous word or a generous gesture is really a marvelous thing of the human heart. And so that was, called dana. The Buddha said, work on that, develop that. And that is a doing, isn't it? We might say, oh, this person is generous or this person is not generous. But the person who is generous is doing generosity, the person who's not generous is doing miserliness. So it is a doing. So from that you start to get a heart or a consciousness which is well grounded, which is settled, which is open, which has some space in it and some lightness in it. That's something we do for a lifetime, isn't it? The more we do it, the more we like it. When we get impulses of generosity, you know, how you feel really grateful for someone that's done something for you, you just want to give back, or you find that someone is got a diagnosis of cancer, and you think, oh, well, how can we feed this person? How can we make them live through this difficulty? And these impulses are very important. And so very important to act on them. Very important to live them out. Sometimes maybe we're shy to do that, but not to, just to, as we say, go for it, to do it. So that's the first kind of level of well-being. First, a foundation for enlightenment, we'd say. And then the second aspect that the Buddha would talk about was the aspect of moral restraint. So generosity is an active part of our social life, or our family life, of our life in with others. Whereas in the teachings on morality, ethics, these are the parts of our being we refrain from following. So impulses of violence and to harm people, impulses of corruption, impulses which in speech are divisive and hurtful, impulses which would take us into infidelity, and impulses which would make us always go to some kind of distractions like alcohol, or just the need to always distract the mind. These kinds of impulses don't give a good result, obviously. So the emphasis on non-violence, ahimsa, very, very big in Buddhism. Or just take like the emphasis on right communication, to really consider before one says something or one writes something on the internet, in an email, will this be for the welfare of my community? Am I pure in this? If I'm criticizing someone, what will be the effect of this? Will it bring concord? Will it bring division? And that kind of pause in speech and in writing and so on is a kind of mindfulness we need to do. And it also brings very good results, doesn't it? Both socially, if there's some kind of an argument going on in my community and people are shooting emails back and forth, blaming, and you know how destructive that can be. I'm sure we've all been caught up or seen that happening. And if I'm in that kind of communication and I refrain from believing in easy judgments are very, very easy. I refrain from just reacting when someone maybe accuses me of something. I have a sense of pause, I have a sense of maturity, I consider how I could effectively respond or communicate. This is very beautiful, very beautiful. And even if someone misunderstands me, I know in my own heart I had no intention to harm, I had no intention to divide, I had no intention to cause division. And there's a kind of security there, from non-violence, from attempting to live in society in a harmonious and good and wholesome way. This takes work. It takes real work to do that. And these two then are the kind of passive and active part of our being. The passive is where we refrain from doing that which is harmful to other beings. And the active, we actively generate and do things which is a benefit of other beings. So both of these bring a kind of social confidence, social security, rather than just the pension from the government. Mm-hmm. A kind of inner security, an inner sense of, I think, healthy belonging. You know, when I live in my community in a way which is morally upright and looks out for the needs of the poor or whatever in my family or society, there is a sense of a wholesome belonging and confidence. So the Buddha would say that's the foundation for enlightenment. So in itself, again, it is something which is very rewarding, very, very rewarding. But morality takes work, ethics take work. Nowadays, there's so many kind of complex ethical problems around euthanasia or chemical warfare in Syria or different ways of reproductive technologies and medical ethics must be it is very, very complicated. So if we have power, if we are in areas of power where we can influence decisions, then we have to have a clear mind. How can we do this? And the more clear we are about non-harming, not hurting, what is the benefit, the easier these difficult decisions will be. So that brings a kind of stability to consciousness. So you can see, if I don't have that in place, like if my, you know, I just inadvertently cheat $2,000 on my tax return. You know, I'm going to sit down and meditate. I'm going to worry about my tax return. It's not going to be really good for my samadhi. So there's a kind of confidence and well-being in the heart from that. And you can see that's a foundation for peace. It's a foundation for enlightenment. And the Buddha talked about the benefits of you might say divinity. So in Buddhism we talk about various levels of consciousness, and we as human beings can experience very hellish modes of consciousness, very addictive and like what we call the hungry ghost realms of addiction and unfulfilled wanting. But also we have a possibility of actually abiding in very kind of divine states of mind. And you think about compassion and empathetic joy. These are really quite high states of consciousness that we can experience. And human beings are awed that way, that we can. I don't know about the deer, if they can experience joy when they see me. I think they're into the apples more. They're just watching me, don't take my apple or don't take my life. You know, they're kind of, I don't think they're so much into my life. And yet I can look at a deer and I can say, hey, you're having a good time with that apple, aren't you? I can feel joy at beauty. I can feel joy at someone else's joy. And so in Buddhist modes of consciousness, that's a kind of divine quality. Not divinity necessarily in a heavenly realm or something outside of ourselves, but something in the heart. And so the Buddhist teachings are encouraging, develop that, develop that which is compassionate and empathetic. And empathy is, like, for me, the core word of that divine quality, where I'm not, when my heart can, like I can look at the deer, and when the deer's eating the flowers in the front lawn, I don't feel divinity. Get off my front lawn. Or in the front, we just planted these plants there. But I don't feel divinity. I feel sad. I feel, those are mine. Go away. Go eat the apples. And I see him eating the apple, I think, oh, you lovely thing. Have a good apple. Mainly because the apples are sour. And I'm not so interested in them. So to actually bring up that quality of empathy, even when maybe it's hard to do, more difficult to do. So if you contemplate things like jealousy, you've got a bigger apple than I have, that kind of thing. Jealousy is a very alienating energy. It's a very, very closing down energy. It's a very separative energy. Whereas empathy at the success of others, the joy of others, the goodness of others. Hey, good on you. Like, I always joke, I see, maybe in February, you've been at work all January, and one of your mates says, "Oh, I'm going down to Nicaragua for some holidays in February." You say, "Oh, I'm envious of you." That's not joy, is it? Darn it, I have to stay and work and slog through the snow. It's not immoral. It's not immoral then, but it's certainly not joyous. It's not joyous. But to actually, to see that impulse in your mind that thinks, that's not fair, I want to go too, and drop that impulse and let go of that impulse, and maybe plan for your vacation, but just let go of that way of relating, I want what you have, and relating in a way, oh, I'm happy for what you have, is a beautiful transformation of consciousness, and it brings joy. It brings joy. And we can do that. We can move towards that which is divine in this particular definition. We can move that way, or we can move towards that which is too much self-concern or self-referencing all the time. So empathy is a beautiful quality. And within those kind of divine qualities, we sometimes talk about equanimity. And equanimity is a kind of empathy with life's ups and downs, that we as human beings experience pleasure and pain, praise and blame, success, failure, good fortune, bad fortune. It's just part of the human predicament. In the mornings we have a reading from the text, and then after that sometimes we're studying our rules as monks, and we're just thinking about the last 10 years of the Buddha. in his life, in his social life, he had a lot of problems. His cousin tried to kill him. He had some, you know, like a faction which tried to make a schism. There were other religious sects who were jealous of him, and so on and so forth. So, I think, well, if the Buddha had all those problems, why should I have any less? So, socially, sometimes, even though we are doing our very best to be generous and moral, lo and behold, people blame us for things we haven't done. And we suffer losses that we think, like some of the losses that people suffered on the market in whatever year that was, were painful for their pension funds. We have a friend whose company went bust and he lost a large part of his pension. These are very painful and very real difficult things. And to kind of feel the loss there and feel the aversion or whatever, but just no. This is life. Life is just some moving towards equanimity, the capacity to be equanimous, not stupid or condoning foolishness that happens in society and still being proactive in whatever way one has to be realistic, but also developing a heart. Yeah, the ups and downs, it's part of it. It's just a given, isn't it? So this lays the foundation of the heart that in a meditative life, contemplative life, sometimes I know for myself, I don't know how you're conditioned. I was very conditioned in a very intellectual way, so I was always trying to figure things out through analysis and then push myself through some kind of idea, force my meditation through some kind of thing that I had read. So I was trying to match my heart with something I had read. I was trying to push away that which I thought I had to push away. And so a kind of a struggle, which was not very, very productive, but it was productive in that I thought it didn't work. That's productive in that way, in that sense. And certainly learn a lot that way. So these heart qualities are very important in meditation because they enter into this present moment in a way which is generous, which is open-hearted. And in that open-heartedness, there's much more insight. The mind isn't sort of crowded out by a lot of selfishness. It isn't conditioned by a lot of willfulness and so on. Because empathy is not a willful thing, is it? It's not like willfully trying to get something. It's an opening. It's a receptivity. You know, something which you have to allow to happen. You know, for me to be empathetic to you, I have to allow you to be present. I have to hear and listen and notice you as a human being. And then that empathy can function. And it's that aspect of being receptive and opening that we notice the way things are and from which insight comes and from which successful meditation comes. So these heart qualities. And you start to add all this up. You see, it's a whole lifestyle of doing. And you can see it's a really profound foundation. And yet that's not yet enlightenment. That's just kind of, you know, that's the beginning stuff. If humanity could just do the beginning stuff, we'd be in pretty good shape. So yeah, you have generosity, morality, and you have these divine qualities. And then the Buddha started to, you know, he would say, well, if you start to look at consciousness now as a stream of events, rather than you just you in a social context, in the context of family and responsibility, look at consciousness as a stream of events and notice that we are sense beings, first of all, that our stream of consciousness is dependent on inputs like sound and sight and memory and taste and bodily feelings and smells, and that this constant input and reaction to life is something that at times is very pleasant. Times are very disappointing. And rather than always just seeking the pleasant and avoiding the unpleasant, the Buddha says, look at the disadvantage of that strategy. And if I'm always chasing the pleasant and trying to get rid of the unpleasant, the very nature of the pleasant is to become otherwise, because it's dependent on all kinds of other causes and conditions. So the very nature of the thing that I'm chasing, the pleasure, the happiness, the comfort, its very nature is to become otherwise. And when it becomes otherwise, then I feel disappointed. And when I feel disappointed, and then I again chase some kind of sense experience, that very chasing, we would say, is grounded in a short term understanding of human happiness. It's grounded in a lack of depth in understanding human happiness or human well-being. And so the Buddha recommends then points to the possible kinds of happiness we can have in the sense world, but looks at the limitations of that and then suggests renunciation or looking inward, say. And renunciation is a very important part of obviously monastic life, but it's not just about monastic life, it's about where we turn to when we have discontent, when we suffer, when we have pain, when we have disappointment, when life throws things at us which are not to our plans or not to our liking. Where do we turn? Do we turn to a compensation? Or do we turn inwards to understand the nature of our suffering, the nature of our discontent? And so the Buddha's recommendation is, live a good life. Do the best you can, but also turn inwards and understand what suffering is really about. And renunciation is that. It's not kind of just shaving the head and wearing funny clothing, shaving your eyebrows. but actually it's a more profound, this is a kind of a symbol of that. This is like an icon almost of that movement inwards that we all do. And the movement inwards is to understand just the very nature of conflict and the end of conflict, the nature of suffering, the end of suffering. To do that, obviously, we need a safe environment, we need enough food, and so on and so forth. It's very hard to do in Syria or these awful places. So we're lucky, we can do that. So the nature of turning inwards is like beginning to watch stream of consciousness and beginning to see that when I, just to really notice, like, sense of disappointment or aversion or annoyance or a sense of lack or a sense of wanting something that I don't have or not wanting that I do have. Looking at that restlessness and lack of stillness in the heart or lack of peace in the heart or suffering or discontent in whatever levels you want. And that takes a very mature kind of mind. It takes a very mature human being to take responsibility for that. The more adolescent kind of human consciousness, which sometimes persists in people for many years, is the more the kind of consciousness which blames or seeks compensations and distractions. So it's your fault. If you were different, I would really be happy. Or if I get another one of those, then I'll be even more happy. And, we've all been there with that. So the movement then to inwards requires a lot of mindfulness. It really requires a very, very deep sense of sustained attention. If one's going to have any, I think, profound insight into what the Buddha was talking about, this can't be a kind of haphazard thing where every now and then I kind of notice what's going on. It has to be sustained inward attention. So we call it inner vigilance. Or awareness on this movement of consciousness, and then the teachings start to begin to offer some analysis of what you need to look at, and this is a doing too. This isn't just a kind of Buddhist belief that you have to take on. It's something you actually have to do. So the encouragement then is that to develop an attitude of awareness, which not only functions in the world in a reasonable and efficient way, but also notices the inner world and watches what's going on. So there's always two levels of attention going on. There's the attention to my cooking the food or driving the car, but there's also this kind of inner vigilance going on. And the more one does that, the more adept one gets. And that's the reflective mind. That not only can I feel love and hate and so on, I can reflect, oh, this is love or this is hate. I can reflect in that way. And without this reflective consciousness, without this sense of objective knowing of the inner world, without that, one wouldn't get very far in Buddhism. One could be a good Buddhist, one could live a good moral life, but without that reflective consciousness, one would tend to just be caught up in those inner movements. There'd be no subtlety of the mind. So then the teaching goes to various places in this, but one of the things I've been talking about during this summer is this teaching which we call this that conditionality. And again, just to repeat the phrase which I've been saying many Saturdays now, it's a law or a rule of nature which the Buddha observed in nature, especially in our own consciousness. And the way he phrased it was this being that comes to be with the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not come to be with the cessation of this that ceases, this being that comes to be with the arising of this that arises. So I was playing with the do it. This being that comes to be with the cessation of this that ceases. Okay? And then with the arising of this that arises. So dependent origination or ida pachayata, this that conditionality. And this is a teaching which the you find throughout the text. It's a very important perception to try to bring into consciousness. So now the Buddha's teaching is now introducing a way of actually interpreting life, not just socially, but also the way I'm reading my inner consciousness, the way I'm actually interpreting, because we're always interpreting life. You know, it's hot, turn on the fan, it's cold, turn on the heater, this is a dog, this is a deer, this is water. So perceptions are just a natural part of a sane life. And this particular perception is one that we don't usually employ. And the particular thing I like to just mention today is that as human beings, we experience life through the senses, as I said earlier. So we feel, you know, like you're sitting now and you have pain in the knee or whatever, and I have pain in this knee and so on. So we are sense beings. We have, and sense consciousness by its very nature has pleasure and pain in it. That's a given. And pleasure and pain is a spectrum from the very, very unpleasant and painful to the very, very pleasurable and ecstatic and all gradations in between to something sometimes in between which is kind of neutral. And that's a given. So sights and sounds and tastes and smells and bodily feelings and mental images have this quality of pleasure and pain. And so the Buddhist teaching on this, that conditionality is asking us, and it's very hard to do, focus on contact. Focus on contact, notice contact. And contact is, because we have the sense bases, and then we have contact. The sense, like when I turn the fan off, you'll be contacted by a different kind of air quality. That's contact, right? And then when I turn it on, the fan will go and you'll be contacted by a different air quality. So that's obvious. And that's just a given. You can't get out of that. And smells and tastes and visual images, bodily feelings, sounds, and mental images, memory, thoughts, ideas. Right? And these so are, and this is going on very, very quickly, obviously. And the thing about that is that the Buddha is saying, well, with sense, with contact as condition, now we go to this, that conditionality, with contact as condition, there is feeling. And that feeling is pleasurable or painful. Okay? And then with feeling as condition, there's craving. With craving as condition, there is attachment. With attachment as condition, there is suffering. And with suffering as with attachment as condition, we say there's birth. And this is a different kind of a birth than one would think of in terms of rebirth over many lifetimes. It's a birth of ego, the birth of self. So let's say someone, let's say you've just cleaned the floor. It's winter. Just mopped the floor. and someone takes their boots and doesn't take them off and walks between the mats, great source of suffering in my monastery, and they leave their muddy tracks all the way up to the door, and then they get on the mat, and then they put the shoes off. Now, so there's visual contact, there's eye contact with nothing immoral, nothing really bad, but so with contact as condition, there's feeling. And what is the feeling? Unpleasant. Why? Because I just mopped the floor. Right? Because I just mopped the floor. So then that gives rise to maybe a sense of annoyance, but that gives birth to a sense of self. And my mind starts to think, you idiot, or get out, or I shouldn't be like that, I should be more kind. That gives rise to ego or a sense of self. And that's birth, and that's suffering. Now, if I have attentive at contact, and I can see the unpleasantness of it, and I can let it go, I can still say to the person, out of your mind, and would you get the mop too? I can do that, fine. But that sense of a person being reborn, or an ego reborn, that's very hard to notice. That's very hard to notice. What happens if I do notice it? I notice the arising of that sense of annoyance, and I just stay, oh, this is unpleasant. Unpleasant feels this way. Then if I watch it, with the cessation of the unpleasant, there's a cessation of birth. With the cessation of that, there's a cessation of suffering. And I watch the tendency towards suffering now, I watch it fall away, and my mind has peace. It's hard to do. Take a memory. So then this same person is a guest for a few days and they come in for breakfast, and as soon as I see them, I don't see them, I see their boots. And I think, slob. Or some such disparaging thought. So that's birth again. That's this ego. And there's the other, there's the sense of other, there's the ego. You're inferior, I'm superior, you're foolish, I'm wise, whatever. And that's suffering, the sense of ego. But if I'm aware at contact, so with contact as condition, there's feeling, I see memory arising when I see the person, and I'm just very careful there. I'm attentive there. I notice. Then that memory, I see that memory trace is creating this unpleasant feeling. It's just a memory trace. And I stay attentive to that, and it ceases. And that ego ceases. Then there's empathy. Then I'm actually relating to the person rather than to my memory. And how often have we done that? You know, you relate to someone through a memory rather than actually to the person. That happens very common. You know, you did this and you did that. Yeah, but that was 5 years ago. Here I am now. Hey, look. And this is happening all the time. It's very quick, very fast. And it was around this area that the Buddha said, we need to be mindful. Be very, very mindful at contact, feeling, craving, attachment, becoming, birth. And that's very quick in the mind. And it's a kind of interesting project to take on because... with this, that conditionality, and you start to apply that, you start to have a kind of sharpness of mind. Rather than just letting the mind wander off into its ego trips and all of the rest of it, you begin to have a kind of inner vigilance, inner attention, which isn't based on a sense of self, which is more based on observance of flow of consciousness. And this was the way the Buddha countered the whole sense of ego, the whole sense of what we call self-view. So rather than talking about I am a person who is feeling anger, the teaching is more with this as condition that arises, this being that comes to be, with the cessation of this that ceases. So rather than say there's a fixed person in there doing this or feeling this, the Buddha said, no, observe actually. Is there a fixed person? Or does that sense of personhood and ego and self, does that just arise dependent on contact, feeling, craving? And so on. How does it really work? How does it really work? You know, before you make the assumption. And these assumptions of self that we have are so powerful, so deeply rooted. I mean, just to talk about this in most places, they think, you know, what's he talking about? You know, come on, get a real life, man. But actually, you know, this whole assumption of selfhood and me and you and other and so on is to be challenged, to be looked at. And so the Buddha introduces this kind of perception, this that conditionality. And as you pick up a teaching like that, as you start to engage with a teaching like that, your mind starts to think that way. You know, it starts to kind of ponder, well, why does he mention this all the time? Why does the Buddha say that? It's not like you understand it right away, because if you understood it right away, you wouldn't need a Buddha. But because delusion is so strong, one needs some kind of entry into his insight. And this is one of the ways he said enter into. So we begin to like make that determination to watch. And so you start to watch that, say, in your meditation practice. You start to just watch sense data. This is hard to do also. Just kind of watching, like as you're meditating, just a thought form come through. And a thought form is just a thought form. And notice how you create a self around that. Oh gosh, I'm thinking too much. There I go again. But that's not true. It's just with some kind of memory as condition, there's a feeling that arises and the sense of self arises. But that's just a thought. There's no fixed entity there. It's just a thought. It's just a movement. And as you begin to see that that's thinking, there is not a thinker. There really isn't. There's just conditionality going, coming and going. There's just this possibility of observing in a silent manner this movement, you begin to be less enthralled by the movement and you're more interested in the silence. You're more interested in the awareness. You're more interested in attention and the object of attention. And the mind begins to turn back on itself rather than always be out into thought, into judgment, into self-view. And it's very rewarding. It's very rewarding because that movement away from that tendency always to go out, to come back to the heart, begins to indicate where there is a possibility of a type of consciousness which is no longer just victimized by pleasure and pain. That's just a victim of that, but actually has a kind of independence and clarity and peacefulness which isn't always just getting born into ego, getting born into self. Take like self-images, how you can have a memory of, I just corresponded with someone I hadn't met for 40 years. This was one of those emails that you get, that someone I knew in India 40 years ago. And when I looked at the email, I said, holy cow. and just this person's perception of me 40 years ago was nothing of my perception of me that I can remember. Very interesting. It was very interesting. It was so different than I thought who I was and who they thought I was and so on. But like self-perceptions, you know, you have like, let's say you're someone who's self-critical, say, right? You have a strong sense of self-criticism and you drop something on the floor and it splatters all the floor and that's contact. And it's an unpleasant contact because the spaghetti is now on the floor. And with contact as condition, what arises? Oh, you idiot, Viradhamma, there you go again. You never do anything right. That's not necessary, but it is a kind of habit, a habit of mind. And then maybe you're watching this, that conditionality, and there's an error in judgment or whatever, and the event takes place, there's contact, and you see how the sense of self arises, and you don't believe in it. Oh yeah, that's the sense of self, that's all. And you don't believe it, you don't buy into it, you don't entertain it. You just say, oh, that's just a thought, that's just a perception, that's all. And you watch, and the perception ceases. And you see the mind empty of ego, empty of self, empty of all that stuff. And you begin to say, wow, that's peaceful. And so you begin to notice cessation of ego or cessation of self, not by getting rid of it, but by noticing it's nothing permanent. It's not who you really are. It's just this, that conditionality. Someone praises you. someone praises you, and you go, oh. Or maybe you feel shy. Oh, you know, I'm no good. I'm no good. No, you're good. No, I'm no good. Or whatever, right? And just, oh, that's a sense of self. Or so even to say that I shouldn't have a sense of self is silly too, because it's just a condition. It's just a condition that arises. And to notice like the ceasing of a sense of self, just to notice that a kind of aversion to someone, or then a fantasy of something you want to buy or get or own or become, and just notice that it arises and ceases. And you begin to abide in that mind which knows the end of suffering, the end of ego, the end of self, the end of becoming. And then that, you see, that's always there. That's always a possibility. It's not something you get through willpower. It's something you realize through wisdom. But the heart has to be open. It has to be a very kind of open, attentive attitude to realize that. All right? So I'll leave that for your reflection. We'll finish with the closing homage.